There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
That's the message from us here at Barasti. Get yourself down here. It is a beautiful evening. There is no place better to be for the next couple of hours. Late afternoon into early evening, and then, well, let's see where it takes you from there. Keep your thoughts coming in on 4001. This is The Grill. 3 hours of sports banter over the next little while. What have we got for you? Man City against Everton is the early kickoff in the Premier League. We'll have all the goals and the action for you on that one. Five kickoffs at 7 p.m. so stay tuned for those ones. We've got Tottenham against Burnley at 7 p.m. that's live here on Dubai I 103.8. that'll be followed by the London derby, Fulham against West Ham. Liverpool against United is tomorrow. That's already thrown up much opportunity for us to talk about that. There's rugby union action as well, but whilst we're live on air, Champions and Challenge Cup action, two tests, Stubbs reports for you. There's golf down in the Kruger National Park. And of course, we'll be talking local sport as well, including the FIFA Club World Cup, which is back with action later on this evening. You're listening to Dubai I 103.8. This is The Grill.
Oh, it's a fabulous goal!
This is The Grill, live from Barasti, with more sport, the latest headlines, and top debate on Dubai I 103.8.
Good to have you on board. Nice to have you as part of the team. My name's Tom Urquhart, and if you'd like to get in touch with the show, there are a number of ways you can do that. You can text us on 4001. Equally, you can have your say online at Dubai I Sport. But the best thing to do is just come down here to Barasti. Have a little stare, come up here to the rooftop bar where we are broadcasting from. It's been refurbished by Phil and all the crew down here at Barasti, and it looks absolutely amazing. Our friend Stella, well, she's on board as well, and she has brought the style with her because it looks very, very stylish up here on the rooftop garden. A little bit of white, a few pictures up, and the best views in town as well of the developments taking place in and around Barasti. So look, if you're looking for something to do, it is that time of year for celebrations and of course reflections, so come on down here and be part of the action. Right, enough hard sell. Who's on the grill panel today? Wonderful to have the man from Nadashiba Club with us, as always, Sean O'Shea, on board to talk football and much, much more. Good to see you, Seanie.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. It's very good to be back. It's been a while since I've been on the radio.
Yeah,
with
what
you guys.
Have you done?
I don't know, I've just been very busy, I think.
Have you offended McCarty or something like that?
I've not offended Chris McCarty. No, not at all.
Made the team for the last couple of weeks. What's going on?
He's just been keeping me on the sidelines, but he's brought me back for the
tough manager,
season.
Tough manager, isn't he?
Tough love.
Sean O'Shea is with us to talk football and much, much more. Mark Archer is also back on. He's got a recall after last week as well. So good to have you back on board, Archer.
Good afternoon, Tom, Sean, and listeners. Yeah, plenty of action, sporting action around the world. Test cricket is happening down under in Perth and Wellington. We'll bring you stumped scores on those two test matches. A fascinating day in Perth and all the highlights from that match. Second test match there with Australia and India. Golf from the beautiful Leopard Creek Golf Club and on the border of the Kruger National Park in South Africa. Score updates throughout the afternoon. And of course, as you said, Tom, bit of rugby union coming. It's Northern Hemisphere club action. It's the Champions Cup and the Challenge Cup taking place this afternoon.
Man City against Everton. We'll give you team news for that one in just a little while. I just want to break away from that and look ahead, if I may. I might be jumping the gun a little bit, but let's talk about tomorrow because we've got a massive game to look forward to. I'm sure a lot of people will be heading home nice and early to watch this one. It's 8 o'clock kickoff. It's Liverpool against United. Let's do all the history if we can first. Fundamentally, it's not a City derby, if you like. It's not City against United, and yet it's gone down in sort of folklore and history and footballing history as one of the great derbies. Why is that, Sean?
I think it's just with the history of Man United Liverpool, obviously back in the 80s when Liverpool were dominating, you know, United weren't so much, and you know, over the last 20-30 years it's just become a huge game. Gary Neville always talks about that it's bigger, almost bigger than the Manchester derby playing Liverpool. It's such a you know, very much talked about game, very heated game, and the two cities, you know, are big rivals, and I think there's a lot of ill feeling between them, isn't there? It's probably the best way I can describe it. But and they're always, well, always great games, aren't they? So I'm like everybody else, looking forward to this one tomorrow. It's going to be an interesting one to see how Liverpool, see how they carry on, and see if obviously if City win today and go back to the top, the pressure's back on them for Liverpool to perform and win and try and go back to the top spot tomorrow.
Mark Archer, a self-confessed Manchester United fan yourself, why is this such a big game?
I think it's the traditional rivalry, the two strongest clubs in the history of British football, I think it's fair to say, Liverpool and Manchester United, through success, for its through many decades now. It's almost a geographical rivalry. It's not far down the road there from Manchester down to Liverpool. And it's just, I think, the history. It's the game with the most historical implications in British football. And so no love lost between the two cities and between the two sets of fans. And for many years now, it's been pretty much Manchester United dominate in terms of Premier League success and Champions League success. But the revival under Jurgen Klopp of Liverpool in the last 18 months has been substantial, and really they are now the dominant team of the two. I think it's fair to say, and their form this season's been unbelievably good. And it's a massive match. In some ways, Liverpool need to keep that momentum going. And Jose Mourinho, and I say it week after week, seems to be playing for must-win matches almost every week now. And all sorts of excuses seem to be coming from Old Trafford and Jose Mourinho. And we know he's the master of the mind games. And interesting play on words that he came up with, I think, yesterday during the press conferences. He said, and he disguised it a little bit, he says, look, all those clubs who are striving for success have to win something. Mm. And he was having a little dig at Liverpool there, saying, for all the football they're playing and all the plaudits they're getting in the media, they've still won nothing, really, of any substance. So they need to start winning stuff, which is difficult, but he's just trying to put the pressure back on Liverpool. They're at home, they're expected to win, but that will play. United as an underdog, I quite fancy United as an underdog with Mourinho. He'll care for something up his sleeve.
I think it's interesting. I watched an interview with Mourinho today, and that comment he's saying there about making a dig at Liverpool, because they asked him about, you know, the Liverpool team of old. Is this the best Liverpool team he's ever seen play? And he said the same thing. He said, well, I've played against Liverpool teams that have won the Champions League, and under Klopp, they've won nothing. So, you know, he is putting the pressure back on them, because he's a man under pressure himself, so he's putting the pressure on them and trying to alleviate himself.
I know it is the season of giving, obviously, at the moment, and he is the gift that keeps giving at the moment, Mourinho, apart from results, that is. He's not getting points at the moment. But I put a question to you that was put to me yesterday. I don't really have an answer. I was talking to a Manchester United fan, and he turned around and he said, OK, who would you rather get rid of? Would you rather get rid of a negative, divisive a key player in the dressing room who is spreading discord and concern amongst his teammates, or the manager? I thought, if ever there was a loaded question, there is a loaded question.
Yeah.
Let's break into that one. If Pogba is said player that we are led to believe that is spreading this discord in the change room, if Mourinho is trying to rein that in, who is the worst of the two?
I think it's the manager. I think it is the manager. For me, if that was put to me as a choice, you know, as a director of Manchester United, I'd get rid of the manager, 100%.
Reasons?
Well, I just think that, you know, I know a lot of people at the club, and, you know, work with a lot of the players and stuff, and I just think the feeling I get is that people actually quite like Paul Pogba. He's got quite a big ego, and he's created this whole brand around himself, like, you know, Beckham did and whatnot. But when you talk to people who know him, like Patrice Evra is obviously very good friends with him, and I know him well, and he says he's a lovely guy. Yeah, okay, he's a bit arrogant and whatnot, but which footballer isn't? You know, I think you have to be a top footballer, you have to be a little bit arrogant and a little bit selfish. But in the dressing room, the players seem to really like him, and the feeling you get is that they don't like the manager. And I think Pogba maybe is a bit of a scapegoat to protect Mourinho in a way, but I think for me it's the manager that's the negative one, I think.
Can we read into this or not, Archie?
Well, you can't sack the players. You can't sack them, you can sell them and you can move them on, but ultimately the manager has a responsibility to get the best out of the talent he's got. And look, and Pogba was a Mourinho signing. You know, Mourinho went out and they wanted to get Pogba, and that was a big signing for him, and I thought it was a big statement at the time that this was the way forward. This is the best young footballer in Europe, really. And you look at what he did in the World Cup for France. He was outstanding on the world stage. He dominated matches like you thought he'd be box to box. He was that type of player. And for United, he just goes missing at times. Mm. And then he has patches of brilliance, and he's just inconsistent. But I ultimately think that the reason Mourinho gets paid the big bucks as the manager is to make tough decisions, but is to maximise the talent, to improve players and to get them playing as a team, and that's what not they're doing. So it's not just a Pogba issue, it's him getting that team moving in the right direction, playing good football and getting results. And it's fine, you can tolerate them as a fan not playing good football if they're winning matches, because I think any true fan will put up with results. But if you're not getting both, if you're playing dire football and you're not getting any results, then something's got to give. And I think what's got to give eventually, probably not during the season, and I've said it often enough on the show, I think if Mourinho's going to go, he'll only go in the off season when they've probably save themselves £20 to £30 million of salary, and once they've lined up the best replacement to take his place in terms of Mourinho.
Shortly, I just want to get your thoughts, whether your coaching cap on, if I can, because let's talk. Continue that conversation about Pogba. Look, he is at Manchester United. It's cost them a lot of money. It has cost them a lot of money in the past with Sol being rebought, etc. Is he being divisive? Is he not playing for the team, or is he being played out of position by the management and the coaching team?
Well, I think there's a little bit of both. I think when you look at him at Juventus, when he played just behind the striker, and he had a lot more freedom, that's when he was at his best. And I think a couple of times last season, I think it was against Swansea and then City when they came back and he scored two goals. When he has that freedom to play in that system, he's a magnificent player. Is he being divisive? Yeah, I think so, because I think from being around footballers and playing football myself, when players don't like a manager, don't want to play for the manager, it's not that they really do it on purpose, but they don't have that ambition or that drive to do well for him. So I think he's just going through the motions a little bit. And I think Pogba's one of those players who needs to be managed really well. And I don't think Mourinho is a very good man manager. You look at the whole episode like with Luke Shaw and stuff, he killed him in interviews and stuff.
Is he not a good man manager now? Has he never been a good man manager? Because this is a man who's had great success as a manager.
Yeah, he has a great success. It's very strange. When I talked to him, I just think for me, he hasn't evolved as a coach. Since he joined Real Madrid, he hasn't evolved and moved with the game. You look at what people call, you know, modern day coaches, like your Klopps, your Guardiolas, your Pochettinos. You know, Mourinho doesn't seem to have moved forward with the game for me. I don't think tactically he's very clever anymore. When he was at Chelsea, he was phenomenal, and Inter won the Champions League with him. And obviously he was very good with Porto. But then since he's gone to Real, he's just been a different person for me. He's lost his mojo. You know, when he came to Chelsea, he was the special one, and he had great players, and they played great football. You know, they played high-paced attacking football, but you watch him last couple of years at United and what he did at Real Madrid, he's just very poor, I think.
Interesting comments by Mourinho as well. He was asked another leading question, as tends to happen at these conferences, saying, is Manchester United playing in Jose Mourinho's style? Are they sort of embodying your philosophy? And he says, no, not at all. And I think the question was same asked about Jurgen Klopp, and Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool play Jurgen Klopp football.
Yeah.
And he was fearing that Manchester United aren't playing Jose Mourinho football.
Well, I think that's the question. What is Jose Mourinho football these days? Because I don't know what that is. If you look at like when he was at Chelsea and they had Drogba up front, you know, they had Duff on the wing and Robin, and you know, they had big athletic players, but they got the ball wide, they got the ball into the box, and they played on the front foot. But at United, it's very much on the back foot. It's almost like trying to defend out and grind out a one or two and win. Like, they were very good last week against, was it West Ham? Fulham they beat last week, didn't they? You know, they played really well, but it's always in flashes. It's always in flashes. Not consistent like your Liverpools and your Cities and your Tottenhams.
The big thing about Man United this year as well is last year, for all their faults, and they had a reasonable season, and he keeps pointing back to that, but they were defensively so good. I think they're the best defensive record in the Premier League. Didn't concede a lot of goals, so you get away with scoring one or two and winning tight matches, and they tended to do that. This year, almost every week they've gone 1-0 or 2-0 down, and they're having to fight their way back into matches, and the team's not set up or built to be a comeback team. They're not a team to score lots of goals, even though they have come back and got some draws and got some late winners. That's not what they're built for. They're built to get a goal and then sit back and then suck up the pressure and maybe hit a team on the break. That's their style, but they've been forced to play a different style by conceding as regularly as they have been early in matches and putting behind sort of the pace and the tempo of the game. It's not playing under their way, and that's been frustrating watching them try to play catch up, and often it's too much too late. They've left themselves too much work to do.
As a Man United fan, who would you have replaced him? If he was safe to go at the end of the season, who would you have replaced him? Who would be your choice?
It's difficult, I think, of available managers.
Any manager.
Sam Allardyce.
Save them from going down anyway.
Or Harry Redknapp. Or Harry Redknapp's in good form. He's not available
at the moment. He's got bigger. He's bigger than.
He'll be on Big Brother next week.
You know, you love to talk about it as Zinedine Zidane, but I don't know if he's the type of manager that could get out of anything out of these players now. So they talk about Pochettino as being an option who has done well there, but can he really actually win anything with Tottenham apart from, and that's the question that will be asked of him. Pochettino seems to be someone that keeps getting bandied around a bit, and not what's the names comes up with the Real Madrid job. So Zidane would be a big name signing. I'm just not sure if that's the right person for that right time at Manchester United. It was easy at Real Madrid. Look, we would have coached Real Madrid to success in some of the competitions. To be honest. But I don't... So the answer is I'm not sure, but I think someone who's been involved in British football, who's done well, maybe needs to take a step forward, which would be Pochettino. But he won't be cheap.
No.
He'd be more expensive than buying Harry Kane, probably. Mm. So that would be interesting to see. And that's the reason... That one of the reasons I don't think they'll sack Mourinho, given... indifference form over this new year period, and he needs to find some results, but I think they'll wait till the end of the season, they line the right person
just
up.
On the back of that though, and if you take the Pochettino question to heart, and if managers these days are all about results and building their teams to look for results, are we getting to a point now, and disregarding the history that is behind Manchester United, but just having a look at them in recent seasons, we're getting to the point where someone like Pochettino goes, you know what, I've probably got more chance to win Champions League or titles with my Tottenham team that I have at the moment that I've built than I do at Manchester United?
It's possible. It is, but I mean, I think if Tottenham backed him, like, I always found it very strange in the summer that they didn't sign a single player, Tottenham. It was very, very strange, and I think that's probably where Tottenham will struggle in the second half of the season. They've qualified for the Champions League next round. They'll be in the FA Cup. You know, they've got the Premier League fixtures coming thick and fast. And if they get three or four injuries, they'll start to falter a little bit, I think. Is he in a position where he thinks he could do better with Tottenham than if he moved to Man United? I don't know. Man United's still a big club and they've got a lot of resources. If they were to throw money at him, I think that it would be very hard for him to turn it down.
Still the biggest club in Britain.
Yeah,
by
absolutely.
A long way.
Yeah,
by miles. Yeah. By a long way. And so that would be a challenge. But if Real Madrid come into the picture, and we always say they always get their man. They did come in for him and he has signed a new contract. If Real Madrid come in at some stage, you just think it's a matter of time before he goes. And
still the biggest club. I take that point. Yeah, and financially and brand-wise and things like that. But in order to maintain that position, you need results.
You need success.
Absolutely. And I think they're probably three or four really good players away from, you know, competing with Liverpool and Tottenham. Well, Liverpool and Man City, to be honest with you. I don't know. You know, like you're saying, Pogba was one of Mourinho's purchases, but it doesn't seem to have worked out. Lukaku was one of his purchases. You know, his marquee signing. That hasn't worked out, really, I don't think, very well. For a player that he got rid of when he was at Chelsea, I couldn't understand the reasoning. Okay, he went to Everton and did well. I couldn't understand the reason of bringing him back. But then again, he does fit, you know, the Mourinho player profile, because he's big and he's strong and he's athletic, and they're the kind of players that Mourinho goes for. He's not one known for developing players, is he, Mourinho? He's one of people who he buys ready-made players and put them into a system. But I think it comes back to that again. I don't think Mourinho really knows what his system or style of play is anymore, and do the players he have fit that system? Well, you don't know if you don't know what your
the system. The biggest thing for me as a fan is they've lost their identity. Yeah. I don't know what to expect, and to be honest, I've stopped watching them. Unless they're on at a premier time, I won't get up and watch a Champions League match unless it's compelling. So Valencia during the week, dead rubber, albeit. And I was almost up at that time of night, 12 o'clock, and I said, no, I'm going to bed. And so I'm happy to watch it there. But if that's me, and I've been a fan for 25 years, if I'm now being turned off watching them because they're not either playing good football or not getting results, then you got to think then it's only a matter of time before that sort of starts cascading into economies and less fan support and less revenues, etc., globally.
You're listening to The Grill. We're broadcasting live from Barasti, where the game is always on. Not just yet. The game is on in around about 10 minutes' time. Man City against Everton. Team news is next.
This is The Grill. Get involved with the show. Text 4001 or message us for free on the Dubai Eye Messenger app.
Getafe against Real Sociedad is underway. We'll keep you updated on scores on that as and when they happen. But we're looking forward to the early kick-off of the Premier League. Man City taking on Everton. Let's get some team news. Shawnee, what can you say?
Yes, got the lineups in here. So we start with the home team, City, going 4-3-3, Edison in goals. Al Walker, Otamendi, Laporte and Fabian Delph, the back four. Bernardo Silva, Fernandinho and Gundogan make up the midfield, with Mahrez starting, Gabriel Jesus starting, and also Leroy Sané up top. But interestingly enough, John Stones is back, he's on the bench. Sergio Aguero's back on the bench. Kevin De Bruyne is back on the bench, and Raheem Sterling on the bench for this one. Everton starts with Jordan Pickford in goals, Keane, Yerry Mina and Kurt Zouma at the back. Coleman and Dignam, I'm sure, will be the wing-backs. Andre Gomez, Gylfi Sigurdsson in midfield, with Bernard, Calvert-Lewin and the very informed Richarlison, very popular Richarlison, starts as well. So obviously City looking to bounce back from that defeat last week against Chelsea to go top of the league, maybe only for 24 hours, depending on what happens in the Liverpool game tomorrow. And Everton, I think, my opinion, have struggled to get form since that late 1-0 defeat at Liverpool. I think that really knocked the wind out. And if they got a draw in that game, I think they'd have carried on with good form. But they've struggled the last couple of games, so be interesting. But the last two games at the Etihad have drawn 1-0. Have drawn 1-1 the last two times we've played. So let's see how it goes. Kicks off in about 3 or 4 minutes.
Let's get some insight on this one. You mentioned there about last game out for Man City. Something of a blip on their record. Not often do you see the word L after Man City in the results. They were playing Chelsea. So what does Pep Guardiola put that result down to? He feels that his team made a few mistakes.
After the defeat in the way we lost the game, I don't have any argument to say something negative to my players. Of course, never will do it here. in the locker room. If they give me this opportunity to have regrets about the day they compete, we'll be in a good path. Maybe we're going to lose one game when we are not like normally we are. But reviewing the game, like we saw, it was incredible, the good we play, considering the huge talent and huge quality of the opponent they have. So we make an incredible first half and accept 18 minutes because we have a little mistake in our movements defensively. The rest of the game, we play in courage.
Well, great for Man City fans, Sean, but good for the Premier League.
Fantastic for the Premier League. I mean, you know, he said himself, Guardiola, that they will drop points throughout the season. There's no doubt about that. I think, you know, the thought of them going unbeaten is ridiculous, really. But you got to give credit to Chelsea. I mean, they've been on form since the start of the season. New managers come in, done very, very well. And to be fair to them, they were brilliant in the second half against City last week. So, like I said, great for Chelsea, great for the Premier League. Makes the title race even more interesting now because it's going to heat up between themselves and Liverpool going forward.
Obviously, they've been in action since then with Champions League duties earlier on in the week. Attention now turning to who they will face in the next stage of the tournament, having qualified for the knockout stages. To his part, Guardiola, well, he doesn't care.
It doesn't matter what happened, always we are lucky. So we have the tendency to underestimate the opponents. So you never know. So sometimes finish first. The fact the second leg is at home, I think, gives you some advantage. But sometimes, always I had the feeling my 10 years being in this stage, and last 16 is they always tough. We will see. Important is to be there. That is the most important thing, to be there. One more year and try to, in this competition, Champions League, when it happened in February, March, arrive in the good conditions and play as healthy, that is gone.
Champions League draw is on Monday, Mark Archer. Man
That's
City,
correct.
Not too bothered, are they?
I don't think so. I mean, but this is a competition they are striving, they have been built to try and win. They haven't had great success in it. And often at this stage now, I think it's the last, how many were we down to? Last 16. So a little bit of luck of the draw here, because depending on where you finish, you avoid certain teams that might be seeded. But then again, some of the stronger teams may have finished second in their group. And then you can't play teams from your own country at this stage as well. So you do get narrowed down about who you may play. So look, they'll avoid some of the big guys. They'll avoid the likes of Barcelona. But you never know. Did Real Madrid finish second in the end in their pool?
Did, yeah.
So Real Madrid are out there for someone. You know, and they've been amazing in the last 4 years in this competition. They've won three times. So
you wouldn't be worried about playing. I don't think you'd be worried about playing Real Madrid this year in the Champions League. I don't think it'd be as big a fear as it would be like the last 3 years. Obviously, they've gone on to win it, but with the form this year in the league and in the Champions League, they've just not been ticking at all. I don't think people would fear them.
There are probably other teams that you'd want to play ahead of Real Madrid.
100%. Yeah, 100%.
But yeah, again, luck of the draw is going to be important now, and then where you get your home and away legs at. But it's always fascinating, and I think the competition will resume in February. So we see so much football now on the club and domestic scene, particularly in the UK in the Premier League over the next sort of month. You know, playing like three times a week.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of football coming, and then hopefully those teams emerge unscathed. This is the time of the year when squad strength really gets tested, and we see who has the depth, who can rest players, who can rotate players, who's going to deal with injuries, who gets a bit of luck on that side, and we'll see who comes out the other side. But interesting to note about City today, on their bench, they have Kevin De Bruyne, they have Sergio Aguero, they have Raheem Sterling. I mean, it's phenomenal. That's three world-class talents off the bench to bring on just to see how the match is going. So he's got the ability to play out the 90 minutes. If they get a comfortable lead, I'm sure he'll try and keep those guys fresh.
Mm.
If not, he's got some serious firepower to bring in and try and get the result.
And that's where I think City will be successful this year, because I think when they rotate their squad, it's almost like for like with the players. It's not like there's a weaker player coming onto the pitch, and I think that's where they'll be really successful. And as you get into the second half of the season with the cup competitions and more games each week, Liverpool, if they have a few injuries or a few suspensions, I don't think their sort of squad is as strong as Man City's. I think that's where they'll
There was that comment in the week, and I don't know if I agree with it, because you've just sort of highlighted it, Archie. You know, there's nothing worse than an injured Man United. You know, you don't underestimate Man United. There was that comment out midweek that, you know, everyone's looking for Man United in the next round of the tournament. That would seem to be a sort of dream draw for them, which is sad. It's sad that we're saying that, or that those comments are being published in the media at the moment. I mean, from what we've seen, I know we've talked a lot about Man United already, but can they turn it around? Do you think maybe that is the impetus, getting a good run in the Champions League, or do you just not see it?
Well, I think they can turn it around because they've certainly got the players to do so. I think there's quality in the squad, and you see in flashes that when they play well, they can play really, really well. Will that turn them around? I don't see it happening. I just think that the mood is so negative at the club and with Mourinho and his demeanour. I don't see them going on a run and getting to the Champions League final or potentially winning. I just can't see that happening.
Do they have? I mean, you've just talked about the bench there as well. If we compare and contrast the two Manchester clubs, do they have that strength and depth?
No, not for me.
No one does. No one in the Premier League has that. I mean, Manchester City could field two sides in the Premier League, and one team would still win it, and the other team would probably finish mid-table.
Chelsea's. You look at Chelsea's bench these days as well. It's strong. Liverpool as well, I think, got a good squad at the moment.
I don't think they have the squad depth that City have, where basically in every position they have world-class talent, probably internationals on the bench, who come into the squad. It's just they have unparalleled sort of strength and depth to any team, and that goes almost throughout Europe. I think that you'd struggle to find another team in Europe that probably really man for man has a reserve side or have a squad. It's probably one or two on a handful, and Sean, you've probably got a few suggestions, but there's not many teams that have that depth now.
No, I completely agree with you. I don't think there is another team in Europe with a stronger squad as Man City across the park. There are obviously great teams and there's good squads. You go through all the major leagues, but I think Man City have definitely got the best 23-man squad you could ask for, really.
Your thoughts would be appreciated. We'd like you to text them to us now, please, on 4001. Kick off in the Premier League. We're up and running. It's The Grill, live from Barasti.
Oh, it's a fabulous goal!
This is The Grill, live from Barasti, with more sport, the latest headlines, and top debate on Dubai Eye 103.8.
4001, if you'd like to have your say on the text message system, at Dubai Eye Sport if you are on Twitter, hashtag Dubai Eye 1038 if you are on the gram and other social media sites. But the best thing to do is vote with your feet. Come on down here to Barasti, make your way to the rooftop garden, which is brought to you by our friend Stella. She's down here at the moment in all her beauty, so feel free to come down and say hi. We can catch up with me, Tom Murko, got Sean O'Shea and Mark Archer alongside me. Archie, let's talk cricket if we can for a while. Let's get some stumps reports. How are things set?
Yeah, test match cricket action is all down under at the moment in Perth and in Wellington, New Zealand. We saw the Black Caps win the series against Pakistan last weekend in Abu Dhabi. They've flown back home and they've got day one of the first test match of the home summer season underway 1 week later, and they're taking on Sri Lanka. So it was day one at the Basin Reserve in Wellington. The Black Caps won the toss. The New Zealand captain, Kane Williamson, elected to field first. Sri Lanka at stumps. They battled their way to 275 for nine. Karunan Akne opening the batting, scored 79. Angelo Matthews with a hard hit, 83. And Nirushan Dikwala finished 73 not out. So Sri Lanka at stumps, 275 for nine. Tim Southee was the best of the Black Caps bowlers. He had a 5-wicket haul. He took 567. Big action also in Perth. It's day two of the second test match. Australia, of course, trailing India 1-0 after that first test match. And stumps scores, I can tell you that Australia were dismissed early today for 326. Marcus Harris 70, Aaron Finch with 50, Travis Head with 58, Ishant Sharma the best of the Indian bowlers with 4 for 41. At stumps, India, they fought their way through to 172 for 3. Ajinkya Rahane 51 not out, captain magnificent Virat Kohli 82 not out. What a player he is. The partnership was unbroken, 90 for the fourth wicket. And so at stumps on day two of this fascinating series, India trail Australia by 154 runs. They have 7 wickets remaining in the first innings. Let's just have a quick listen to the action as it came in from Perth earlier this afternoon.
We're starting out for Australia today, a lead of 277. At the end of yesterday, they would have been a lot happier than the Indians.
Oh, straight through him! Cummins is knocked over. Yadav gets the wicket.
Angled in and off the track. It just does enough. He didn't do a lot wrong there, Pat Cummins. Just slightly played the wrong line, but it did hold its line beautifully.
Finger goes up!
Out on that evidence. It's going to hit leg stump.
The wicket of Pat Cummins and now Tim Payne, who battled away all morning session.
Edge, the catch is taken. So there you are, another wicket. Suddenly India starting to get the wickets.
Well taken, Rishabh Pant.
Oh well, he might be again. There we go. So Ishan Sharma's come and polished off the tail. Oh, got him. First ball. First wicket down. Once again, Murali Vijay, once again, Mitch Stark. And India haven't got the start they wanted.
Well, look at the reaction from Mitchell Stark. Who knows how much of this questioning and criticism may have been playing in his mind, but you cannot question that.
To rub salt into the wounds, it's lunch, so it's not going to taste very good for him.
Well bowled! Josh Hazlewood! What a beauty!
Kale Rahul, like, all round it. Well, it was almost landing on the crease line, and just that late swing, delight on the face of Josh Hazlewood. Australia have two early ones.
Oh, what a shot. To meet that full delivery, that is classy stuff from Virat Kohli early on.
Catch it. Edge down the leg side, and they've got their man. Pujara, the wall has been knocked out. That's the indication it came straight off the bat. Tim Payne moves nicely. He knew straight away.
That's hit away hard from Rahane. He really is playing all the shots. That's one of the best of the day. That'll go all the way down to the rope, and that's 50 to Virat Kohli. Fourth versus Australia, and his first in 9 innings.
He plays the pull shot again. Rahane enjoys playing the pull shot. He says, thank you, I'll put 4 more into my kitty. Shot. Oh, in the middle of an excellent spell from Hazlewood, here's a riposte from Virat Kohli.
That's into the gap as well. It'll just be the one. It'll be 50 for Ajinkya Rahane. He's 17th in Test match cricket. A beautiful deflection. It's short. Another boundary. Brilliant batting, well bowled, and there's the appreciation. A partnership unbroken of 90. Captain and vice captain will take India to 3 for 172.
That's the Indian score of the stumps on day 2 of the second test match in Perth. 172 for 3. Best bowler for India early in the day was Ishant Sharma. He took 4 for 41. This is what he had to say about sitting back in the dressing room and watching Virat Kohli go about his business at the crease.
Whenever he's batting, obviously, you know, we feel pretty confident when he's batting on the crease. So we felt good, obviously. You know, we finished a day on a strong position. So hopefully if they both will continue tomorrow. So, you know, the game right now, I can say it's equal. So tomorrow, hopefully, we'll win the first session, you know, and then turn a game in our favour. We know that when Pujara defends, you know, ball doesn't go past, you know, to the square even. So we were pretty happy about that. But I think, you know, he's someone you need in your team, because I've played against him. I know that how difficult to bowl Pujara. And yes, you know, that when he plays, you know, he makes a bowler really tired, because he takes that role on from the bowler and everything. So I think when they were batting, we know that, you know, if he stays on the wicket, he can do the wonders for the team. But I think it's very unfortunate the way he got out, actually. We don't get those kind of wickets, you know, then going bowler ball down the leg and then got caught behind. So, yes, it's unfortunate. And when Jinx and Virat was playing, I think when Jinx came in, he played a pretty good shots, and then, you know, shift the momentum in our side. So I think we ended the day pretty well.
Certainly one of the most influential, if not the best player on the planet at the moment, Virat Kohli, goes without saying. How integral is he to India and India's success at the moment? I saw Pujara obviously coming in with the scoring runs today as well, but we've seen in the past, if Kohli's not getting runs and performing or anchoring in innings, India don't perform.
Yeah, he's vital, but he just leads from the front. You know, you watch him in the field when India are bowling, and he's just so intense. And when he's batting, today I watched quite a bit of this earlier, he's just on. He's switched on, and he's just the... When he's there, you just know he can take a game away from you so quickly. And when he's focused and he's not making mistakes, he forces the bowl. And look, Australia have a good seam bowling attack as well. Mitchell Stark, Josh Hazlewood, Pat Cummings. That's as good a trio as you probably have in world cricket. On their conditions, hard, fast, bouncy wicket. And Virat Kohli's just in control. Whilst he's at the crease, India are calm. The scoreboard ticks over. You know, they have momentum going in their direction. You just wonder if he gets dismissed. Can they score the runs? Who's going to really step up and put a dent in the scoreboard? We saw Pujara do it in the first test match. Rahane played really well today. He was really aggressive, which kind of, in some ways, took the pressure off Kohli to score quickly, because Rahane was dominating and paying a lot of aggressive shots. But he's just the man. He's an intimidating presence. And you know, as a bowler, if you make a mistake, he's going to punish you. Yeah. He's not going to let you get away. There's no freebies with Virat Kohli. If you bowl a bad ball, he's going to hit you for four. If you bowl a decent ball, there's a chance he's going to score off it. So he's just psychologically so imposing, so focused, and such that sort of the man. He is the man for India. And, you know, 82 not out, it was a wonderful innings. His ability to notch his game up a step or two and just take the game away from you. So that being said, the match is very well poised. Australia, you know, with India 172 for three, the commentators said at the end of today's play, look, if they can take one wicket, if that's Kohli, or break this partnership, and it's quite a long Indian tail, if they can get into the tail, then they have a chance, and that's game on. So the game's really well poised after 2 days, and it's fascinating Test cricket at its very best. So it's been compelling viewing in the last 2 days.
From an Australia perspective, who have been the standout players for you, not just in this game but in this series so far?
Well, I think that in this match we saw a lot of their batting's been wasn't great in the first Test match, but a couple of their youngsters, Marcus Harris, a new name, he scored 70. The opening partnership of 112. Aaron Finch has been under pressure. We know him more as a T20 player, as a 50 over cricket. He's a very aggressive opening batsman, plays the franchise cricket around the world, and he's really been thrown in due to the suspensions of the Steve Smith and the David Warner and the Cameron Bancroft situation. He's been really elevated, and he's not really known as a red ball cricketer, but he's done well. He scored 50. He was under pressure. Mitchell Stark, you know, for many people, many Australians, he's an amazing bowler, but he just seems to be inconsistent at times, and I think the Australians get a bit frustrated with his inconsistency about knowing how good he could be. So he was good in this Test match as well, to date, under pressure for them. But one man who did have something to say about the form of Mitchell Stark was the former Australian captain Ricky Ponting, talking about how good it is to have as a captain amazing array of fastballs like he did in his tenure there, you know, the Glenn McGraths and the Brett Lees and these types of players. But he talks about the form of Mitchell Stark after today's play.
Oh, got him, first wicket down. Once again, Murali Vijay, once again, Mitch Stark.
I thought he started really well today, and it's continued on now. I just said on commentary then that it looks like he's in better rhythm today than he has been, certainly was in Adelaide. I mean, the thing that struck me most about Adelaide is that he started the game well, and then for some reason it looked like it just went downhill from there. But no, look, spot on today. He used the new ball well. Got Murali Vijay with a beauty back through the gate, which is what we sort of expect from him with the new ball. And so far, his rhythms look really good. His pace has been up. I think last spell there, he's in sort of mid-140s, so some really good positive signs from him.
What's it like having command of a player as captain that can break those partnerships? He might not be the most consistent bowler, but he's got that wicket-taking ability.
Well, he has. I mean, he looked back to Adelaide as it was. Everyone criticised him down there, but he walks away from the Test match with 5 wickets.
Oh, is that an edge? It is! Perfect response from Mitchell Stark. Thank you very much.
You know, that's just the sort of bowler he is, and I think that's what everyone just has to accept about him. He's not going to be brilliant every day, but when he is, he's going to take wickets for you. And I mean, even he takes wickets without being at his absolute best. So what he does, though, is complements the others really well. You know, with Cummins and Hazelwood doing what they do, and Nathan Lyon always bowling tight, it gives you the flexibility as a captain just to go to someone like Mitchell Stark when you need to break through. And look, he's done that for Australia for a number of years, and we'll continue to do so.
Big Yorker
with great strike rates. Mitchell Stark's got the best for an Australian with more than 100 wickets, but you captain, like, 8 of the top 10. What's it like having a bowler with such an impactful strike rate that can crack the game wide open?
I obviously made all the records for those guys as captain. I had nothing to do with the bowlers. I didn't even know that. You know, I had no idea about the strike rates of some of those guys, but I made a look back to the guys that I was lucky enough to captain. I had some of the all-time greats, and for Stark to be at the top of that list just goes to show how valuable he is to Australian cricket and the Australian cricket team. You know, he's a wicket-taking machine. We say that all the time. And I think, you know, the reason that he sometimes creates some criticism is because everyone can see just how good he can be, but people shouldn't expect that he's going to be at his absolute best every day. It's very rare for anyone to be at their best day in and day out. So, but when he is, as you say, with that record he's got, he's pretty damaging.
It's amazing, that record. I just want to hit on that, because I wouldn't put him at the top of that list, and maybe that's my fault for underrating him. But again, just reiterating what Ricky Ponting was saying there, it puts it into perspective how important he's been to, how important he is to Australia at the moment, how important he has been to Australia in recent years.
Exactly, and we talk about it often, or I talk about it often, that you need to take 20 wickets to win a test match, and how do you do that? Well, you have guys that can take wickets. Rather than be sort of tight and economical, you need guys that can take wickets, and Mitchell Starc does that. So he tends sometimes, if he loses the radar, he could go for a few runs, but the ability to take wickets and have wicket-taking deliveries in your armoury is so important for a fast bowler, and he does do that time and time again. So the ability to strike at the top of the Australian order for them, and you look at those guys under Ponting, the likes of Mitchell Johnson and Brett Lee and Glenn McGrath and these types of players that he played with at Era, some of the best of all time. But then Mitchell Starc's record or strike rate is stronger or better than them. It does go to say, but yeah, frustrating, I guess, sometimes if he is inconsistent. But you've got to give him that to then go with the brilliance. You can't have it both ways. You can't be, you know, top of off stump, nibbling away there, bowling a lot of maidens, but would you rather have a guy that goes a few runs and picks up wickets, which is more invaluable? Do you want to take 20 wickets to win a test match? You want the back the guys that take the wickets for you.
A few oohs and ahs from the early game in the Premier League. We'll get back to the cricket in a few moments' time, but Sean O'Shea's watching Man City against Everton for us. What can you tell us?
Well, we're about 20 minutes. It's been a great game so far. It's been fairly even up until the last few minutes, and City have really sort of started turning the screw on them now. But Everton have had two great chances. Dominic Calvert-Lewin had a chance in the opening minutes that Edison put around the post, although it wouldn't have counted because he was actually offside in the end. And then after about 15 minutes, Richarlison, there's a cross delivered into him and he couldn't get over the ball, and he's put it over the bar. But City now just had a free kick on the edge of the box that they worked in and broke to Delph. Delph struck it, just gone over the bar, and then another cross just gone into the box, and Jesus nearly scored, but Pickford made a great save and put it around the post for a corner. But 21 minutes in, City are on top, but it's still 0-0.
Keeping an eye on that one, and keeping an eye on the cricket for you as well. Kevin, thank you very much indeed for your text message. Kevin has texted in to 4001 with his comments saying, Tom, you are wrong. You're not wrong there, Kevin, that's for sure. I am often wrong. quite happy to be wrong as well. But he says, look, Kohli didn't have a good first test match, and yet India went on to win. Evidence there that there are others picking up the pieces if Kohli does not perform on those rare occasions.
Yeah, Chhatishwar Pujara had a wonderful first test match. I think he scored a century in 70 and almost 200 runs in the match for India. He's key because he's the guy that bats at three, difficult position, holds the glue together. He gives Kohli the license to play his own natural game. But today it was Rahane that came in. Oh, we have action and we have some goals.
Just have to cut you off midpoint there, Arch. Sorry about that. City have scored. Jesus has scored. City 1-0 up. Great ball through. Keeper's come out. Great finish under the goalkeeper into the bottom corner from Gabriel Jesus. And I said moments earlier that City were turning the screw. It was a poor clearance from Everton. They broke, played in behind. Definitely not offside. Definitely offside. And a great, great finish under the keeper from Jesus. City 1-0.
1-0. Keep an eye on that one for you. Back to the cricket as well. You were saying, Arch?
I was just saying, yeah, I mean, they do need other players to step up. Chhatishwar Pujara was the man in the first test match for India. I think he scored almost 200 runs between both innings. Ajinkya Rahane stepped up and put that partnership of 90 together, undefeated partnership for 90 with that fourth wicket with Kohli. So Kohli is the key man, but other players do need to chip in for India. They do have quite a long tail, so if you can get through Kohli, you'd always feel as though you're in with a chance of knocking India over. But look, give them credit where credit's due. They won their first test match in India for 10 years with a victory in Adelaide, and they're trying to back it up, and it's well poised at the moment. But I do expect Australia to fight back pretty strong. They'll be first session tomorrow. The new ball is due in about 10 overs. That will be key for Australia, trying to knock over a couple of quick wickets, including Captain Kohli. That will get them back in the game and with a sniff of getting a first innings lead.
Cricket down south at the moment, New Zealand against Sri Lanka and Australia against India. Both those games ongoing. Not much up north at the moment because, well, it's freezing up north at the moment. But there is news emanating from English cricket at the moment. Ashley Giles has been the man that has been announced to take over from Andrew Strauss as England's director of cricket. Difficult one, this one, isn't it? Because obviously Andrew Strauss has had such a successful tenure in that role, but because of personal reasons and his wife's battle against cancer at the moment, he's chosen to spend more time with her and the family and stand down from the role.
Yeah, Ashley Giles is a solid performer. He's probably done most of those jobs in England. I think he even coached England for a very short while before he was removed from that role. So It's a bit of a, I mean, Ashley Giles' successful career with England, with Warwickshire, he's done the different coaching roles, director of cricket roles, and he's come into the ECB, and it's a pretty safe pair of hands, I guess is a good term there for Ashley Giles, and I'm sure he'll give some continuity to it. Big summer, of course, for England at home in a Cricket World Cup early next summer in the Northern Hemisphere, and then they have the Ashes, Australia, then travelling to them. So they'll be happy to have some continuity, some similar type of thinking, of course. Ashley Giles played a lot of cricket with Andrew Strauss, and he'll have a similar way of going about things. He's a nice guy, Ashley Giles. He's a very personable bloke.
King of Spain, isn't he?
King of Spain, exactly. Yeah, turns it straight off the square. So, yeah, no, he'll do a good job, and that's good for England. Of course, a lot of pressure on them next year. They named their team to go to the Caribbean in January for test match and short forms of the game, and it's pretty much they've stuck with the same team that toured Sri Lanka recently and had some good success there. So continuity is the name of the game for England, and they've done so in the appointment of Ashley Giles.
Quick mention whilst we're on the subject of cricket, about West Indies as well. They've been in that series against Bangladesh recently. Bangladesh wrapping up the series, winning this latest ODI by 8 wickets. So that sees them win the series against West Indies. Again, problems we talk about, don't we, Archie, time and time again. West Indies on the road. So difficult to call.
Yeah, and so many of their players are in and out of the squad, yeah. Whether they're playing franchise cricket or being available for the West Indies, and it's always hard to get a gauge on actually where they're at, because you never know whether they've got their full-strength team, and they do struggle away from home. But let's hope that they get some of their big-name players back in early in the year, and they've given England under some pressure. England have been much improved in Test match cricket recently, that great win in Sri Lanka, and they've been the form team in ODI cricket, so it's a big test for the West Indies at home. Used to be that feared place, wasn't it? No one won in the West Indies. Everyone in the 80s and early 90s, the West Indies just dominated everyone, home and away, but particularly at home in the Caribbean, whether it be in Jamaica or Barbados or Trinidad, they were almost undefeatable. But now teams have got over that sort of psychological hurdle that the West Indies aren't what they used to be in Test cricket particularly, and England will go there with a pretty good chance of probably some good success.
It's just, it's sad, isn't it, because there's a great fan of, and having grown up in an era when the West Indies were so dominant in the world of cricket and gave so much entertainment, you know, you want to see West Indies playing that brand of cricket, you want to see West Indies playing cricket at the moment, and yet you can't help but ask, you know, what is the value of them going on a tour to Bangladesh at the moment? Is that bringing value through the gates for Bangladesh cricket? And yet at the same time, where's their place in international cricket at the moment? Because they seem to have developed now, and you mentioned there about the pressure from a number of their marquee players that just don't want to play for them week in, week out, but will play for them for big tournaments. So are we looking at them now as a tournament team?
Yeah, in some ways you are. We talk about that big divide, particularly say in Test cricket or even ODI cricket, about the sort of the top tier and the second tier, and the West Indies and the Bangladesh are probably in that second tier of teams. Now you look at in that top tier, the likes of England, South Africa, India, who are number one ranked. You throw in Australia, you throw in the Black Caps as well with some of the form, and Pakistan, you know, at home in the UAE have been very good. And then you struggle to see where those second tier of countries slip in, like the West Indies and Bangladesh and Sri Lanka, you know, and that mix there, Zimbabwe come into that mix as well. So there is sort of a two-tiered amongst the top teams in world cricket. And I think it's without saying, the West Indies are probably stronger in the shorter forms of the game if they get their big players back in T20 cricket, where they've won a World Cup in recent years. That's probably at their most dangerous. But you just never quite know what you're going to get with the West Indies. They're a very difficult team to predict and read. But they need to keep playing these fixtures. They need to keep being exposed to international cricket. And people need to keep believing in the West Indies concept. It is a unique... It's a bit like the British and Irish Lions at rugby, where once every 4 years you get that interesting mix of British and Irish Lions together. The West Indies is made up by, what, 5, 6, 7, 8 different countries. And they come together under... It's the only thing that unites West Indies is these different countries in the Caribbean playing cricket together. And that's been one of the remarkable stories over the history of Test cricket, really, how they've brought together these different people from different islands to play together in that West Indies team. And it has been a wonderful thing, and long may it continue, really.
Third of the way through the show, time for the latest news headlines at 5 o'clock. Stay tuned for that one when we come back. We talk cricket, both international and local, and also football as well, international and local. So stay tuned for all of that up after the latest news headlines.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.